Eyes Peeled Stories of Our Times fan. That's you. Next week, we'll have a new name, The Story. If you see The Story in your feed, that's us.
We'll still be telling one remarkable story in depth each day with agenda-setting journalism from Times and Sunday Times correspondents.
We won't have vanished. Our name is just changing. Fear not. So look out for The Story in your podcast feed.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Russia goes to the polls today. There are zero prizes for guessing who's going to win.
Russia! 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 Спасибо!
Vladimir Putin has renewed his vice-like grip on power as Russia's president.
The election is a nod to the niceties of a normal, functioning democracy. But in the time that America has had five presidents and Britain has gone through seven prime ministers, Putin's authoritarian regime has clung on to power. He's now about to become the longest-serving Russian president since Stalin.
He will win. Any kind of significant opponent, actual opponent, is either in jail or marginalized. And Russia really has become a much more authoritarian place.
For those wanting to publicly mourn Alexei Navalny's death, this was the response. Dozens were arrested in at least 21 cities across Russia.
The only chink in Putin's ironclad grip on the Russian state appeared last summer when a mutinous band of mercenaries began a march on Moscow.
A mutiny. Perhaps even the start of a civil war. Mercenaries belonging to the Wagner Group, who'd been fighting for Russia in Ukraine, now appear to have seized control of the Russian city of Rostov-on-Don.
So what happened to the Wagner Group? With the mutiny quashed and their leader killed, where did they go? You're listening to Stories of Our Times from The Times and The Sunday Times. I'm Manveen Rana. Today, what Wagner did next. The rebranding of Putin's secret weapon.
I'm Dr. Jack Watling. I'm the Senior Research Fellow for Land Warfare at the Royal United Services Institute in London.
Jack, we've looked at Wagner quite a lot on this podcast, but just take us back to the last moment most people will have heard of them, which is back in July last year, when it looked as though forces under Evgeny Prigozhin were actually advancing on Moscow. What looked like a potential coup. Just remind us of what was happening.
I would frame it as a mutiny, and it was very specifically Wagner as this mercenary organization that had been providing troops to fight in Ukraine, being used as the vanguard of a faction within the Russian military that was deeply dissatisfied with how the war was being fought. And they were essentially going to the Tsar, to Putin, of which there's a long tradition in Russian history, to make a petition, which is that Shoigu, the Minister of Defense, and Gerasimov, the head of the General Staff, should be removed from post. And ultimately, their demonstration of force, their march towards Moscow, was not met favorably by Putin, and so it collapsed.
For everybody watching in the next few weeks, it was almost a miracle that Prigozhin survived as long as he did. Remind us what happened to Prigozhin in the end, but also what was happening behind the scenes in the Kremlin in terms of working out what to do with Wagner.
So Wagner was a very large, complicated, interlocking series of corporate and military structures that were deeply entwined with the Russian security state, with the GRU, Russian military intelligence, and was running operations across Africa, across the Middle East, and in Ukraine. And so given the centrality of Prigozhin as somebody who had almost fallen into managing this structure unintentionally, the Russian state needed to work out how they were going to manage the continuity of that organization while removing Prigozhin and those commanders who were very loyal to him from power. Ultimately, the predictable thing happened. Prigozhin died in a plane crash, which the Russian state reported as an accident, but it was a very convenient accident.
The final seconds of a private jet. On board, reportedly, the head of the Wagner mercenary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin. Look over there by the farm. It's burning, the eyewitness can be heard saying. In the distance, a giant cloud of smoke.
But this took some time. This took a couple of months. And in the intervening period, the Russian state essentially worked out which bits of the security state were going to take over with the different parts of Prigozhin's business empire. So the SVR, the Foreign Intelligence Service, took over the information operations component. The FSB took over a lot of the domestic businesses. And the GRU became directly responsible. They had been running the operations anyway, but they became directly and explicitly responsible for cohering the overseas operations and the operations in Ukraine.
And Jack, Prigozhin, when he was killed, wasn't alone. Some of the most senior people in Wagner were killed alongside him. Was there also retribution for the foot soldiers who'd marched towards Moscow? How easy is it for the Kremlin to step in and take control through its various agencies of a group that was quite mutinous?
So individuals like Dmitry Utkin, who was call sign Wagner, he was the original individual who the mercenaries that became the Wagner group built out from in the Donbass. And a few of the other senior commanders were also on this aircraft when it was destroyed. And I think for those individuals, they had built up over time a sense of corporate identity, a sense of mission, and their continuing service was fairly incompatible with the continuation of Gerasimov's leadership of the military. And so it's not entirely surprising these people were also killed alongside Prigozhin.
And for the rest of Wagner, were they quite happy to take on a new leadership?
I don't think that many Wagner fighters were thrilled by developments, but ultimately the majority of them have returned to the fold in one way or another, very often under different contracting arrangements, better pay, employment on different kinds of missions. But if you were one of these fighters, then your livelihood, your reputation, your future largely was tied in to your employment. And so over time, the shockwave that went through the organization has settled. And there's been a strong push by the Kremlin to eliminate a lot of the bonding identity that existed between these different fighters operating in different countries by suppressing Wagner insignia and trying to arrest some of the propagandists who were very supportive of an ideology alongside the military entity.
That's so interesting. So the government have deliberately tried to suppress some of the Wagner Group's identity. Just step back a moment and remind us where the Wagner Group came from, how it emerged, and what that identity came to represent.
When the Russian state decided to try and collapse the Ukrainian government in 2014, they destabilized eastern Ukraine by pushing in Russian soldiers in relatively small numbers, special forces, but also Russian nationals who were used as the backbone of locally raised forces to fight the Ukrainian military. And one of the more capable elements that developed became the Wagner Battalion, which continue to receive funding and equipment from the GRU and also receive more and more personnel who would be pushed in. So its size expanded quite considerably. Then when the Russians started to intervene in Syria, they again wanted to reduce the exposure of the Russian military to ground operations. And so they took some of these same individuals and sent them into Syria. And this worked fairly well. And so they then employed them on other missions. And over time, you ended up with this community of former Russian service personnel continuing to work with the Russian military all around the world. And it became a community that started to embody quite cohesive values, nationalist, aggressive, patriotic. And this became a structure with a corporate identity.
So it starts off really in a way that allows the Russian government to be active in a country without having their fingerprints all over it, by having what they call plausible deniability. How does that play out in places like Syria, where I understand the Wagner Group actually had a confrontation with America?
Precisely. The US had forces working with the Kurds, primarily in Syria, to fight against Islamic State. Russia was trying to prop up the Assad regime. And this created parts of the country where you had both Russian forces and US forces in the same battle space, which is obviously a very dangerous thing. Now, the Russians wanted to make the US feel uncomfortable. They wanted to push the boundaries, and they wanted ultimately to bring some of those territories under Assad's control. And so if they were going to do that, then rather than use Russian service personnel, they could use mercenaries. One of these instances happened in the Euphrates Valley, where a battalion-sized element backed by artillery and armor pushed across the deconfliction lines, essentially, and towards a US position. And the US asked the Russian government whether these were Russian troops.
General Braga says he immediately picked up a hotline to the Russian military.
So you called and said, stop this?
Yes, I did.
What response did you get?
Those are not our forces.
And so the US completely obliterated these units using a very large quantity of air power, primarily.
200 to 300 of the Russian force was killed. Is that accurate?
Well, that's, I would say, close to our estimates as well.
What this meant was that there were a couple of hundred wounded and many, many killed Russian personnel employed by the Russian military. But it meant that even the Kremlin could, you know, not acknowledge the operation. They could downplay the escalation risk. And they could also tell the Russian public that the Russian military hadn't taken any casualties. I think it's very important that we acknowledge that this is not plausible deniability. This is implausible deniability, right? There was no ambiguity that these people were employed by the Russian military. It was Russian military aircraft that flew them into the country. They were Russian tanks and weapon systems and artillery pieces and ammunition that they were receiving directly from the Russian government. And there were a proportion of Russian military intelligence officers embedded in these units. So what it provided was a mutual ambiguity that both sides could use to avoid having to acknowledge that they were in a fight. And very often that was convenient for us as much as it was convenient for them.
Coming up, how did the Wagner Group spread across Africa, and why is Putin so desperate to keep them there? Before that, though, just a quick reminder. The Wagner Group aren't the only ones having a bit of a rebrand. As of next week, Stories of Our Times will become The Story. Different name, but the same in-depth storytelling with the best guests to help make sense of the news. So look out for The Story in your feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Jack, talk us through what was happening at the same sort of time around bits of Africa. I mean, this is where I first came across Wagner, where they were suddenly popping up absolutely everywhere.
The Russian government, since 2011, had an interest in expanding their sphere of influence and rebuilding many of the connections that they had had as the Soviet Union. And so we started to see things like Russian intelligence reaching out to African officials who had previously studied in the Soviet Union or in Soviet universities, who by now are relatively senior bureaucrats and politicians, and to kind of invite them to the embassy for a yearbook regathering, this kind of thing. Cultural outreach, but trying to map and understand where they actually had these relationships. And what they realized, especially after 2014, when sanctions started to be imposed on Russia, was that they needed to build allies and partnerships away from the West so that they would not fall under Western sanction and be locked out of the ability to trade and access resources. The actual amount of trade that emerges from this is limited, but it buys them a lot of access and goodwill. And then one of the things they realize is that actually the West has been trying to improve the security situation in many of these states for a long time, but has essentially been trying to do it on the cheap because we had other areas that were higher priority. And those efforts have not been going very well. And so the Russians essentially start making the pitch to these countries that they could do a better job. And the tool that they propose is the Wagner Group, because this is a deniable set of forces that the Russians can deploy while simultaneously maintaining the fiction that they are complying with the international rules-based order, even as in the Central African Republic, which is really the first major Wagner success case, they completely violate the UN Security Council resolutions in terms of arming the government and enabling it to conduct offensive operations against rebels.
Wagner was invited in to the Central African Republic by the government to help crush a rebellion. The government depends on Wagner for its survival. Wagner pays itself in gold. The people are left starving.
I mean, in the Central African Republic, they're pretty much pulling the strings for the government on almost all bits of policy. We've done a podcast on this, so if listeners are interested, they should go back and have a look. You sort of suddenly get this model, as you set out, where the Russian government goes in and does these diplomatic deals. You've got Wagner going in and providing security at a time when the West wasn't really doing a very good job at that. You've also got oligarchs going in and buying mining rights around the same sort of time. It was a model that was working really well. And then last July, everything with Wagner gets put on hold. Everybody wanted to know what would happen next. What has happened next?
So I think it's very important to just go through a little bit of how the Wagner Group was packaging this as a proposal. What they would do is they would essentially go to the elite of a country, so its leadership, and say, at present, you have Western forces who are coming in and telling you how you can operate. They are encouraging you to take out large loans, whether through the IMF or others. And they are essentially using aid money and other things to burden you with so much regulation, which they control, that they are practically colonial in the level of influence that they hold. And look at the outcomes. The outcomes are bad. And so what we, the Russian government, propose is that we will provide troops that are directly under your control. We will provide protection to you, both diplomatically, so that the West can't isolate you, but also to you personally, so that your public can't attack you. We will provide information operations, propaganda, to enable you to sell what you are doing to your own public. And you can offset the costs of our operations by getting rid of these Western companies and giving us mining concessions, often for gold, because you can exchange it anywhere into cash. You essentially get our services for free, as far as the state coffers are concerned, which to many leaders sounded very, very attractive.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the realities down the line were rather more pernicious, but it sounded attractive. Now, when Prigozhin was killed, or when the mutiny happened, many of these leaders obviously were concerned because it suggested that there was going to be a threat to the security architecture that had been built up around them. But the Russians were very, very quick to send the deputy head of the GRU, General Avryanov, along with the deputy defense minister, Yevkurov, to visit these states. And they essentially openly told them, this was in July, August last year, that everything that Wagner had agreed with you will now be honored by the Russian Ministry of Defense, and you will deal directly with the Russian Ministry of Defense, which for a lot of their partners in Africa was actually an improvement, because it meant that the Russians had dropped the facade of pretending that this wasn't a direct relationship with Russia. They'd denied that publicly. And so the leaders themselves often feel that they have a better relationship with the Russians now, or at least one where the Russians are more tied in. That actually makes them feel more confident, I think, rather than less.
And Jack, give us a sense of what Wagner 2.0 in its current guise looks like in Africa. How big is it? How many members does it have? Where is it operating?
Wagner was operating right across the continent. It had gone into the Central African Republic. It had a relatively small but persistent footprint in Sudan. They had attempted to build out one in Mozambique, but that had gone very badly. And they had successfully built out a relationship in Mali. What has happened since is they moved into Burkina Faso from December last year. And it's interesting to see the sequencing of how that happened. So the first people to show up were GRU officers this time. They started embedding with the military. They started to spend a lot of time around the junta's leadership. And now we are seeing Wagner troops move in. Their first priority has been to establish a presidential protection force. They are then going to start doing the same thing that they've done in Mali, which is putting companies into battalions of the military. In Mali, the process is much more advanced. Numbers fluctuate between about 1,000 to 2,000 troops, but there they already have established a gold refinery in the international airport. They are out on the ground conducting offensive operations with the Malian military. And it's worth noting that they've taken over 100 casualties in those operations. So it's not a hands-off or small, light touch kind of approach. The Russians are very much getting stuck into the fighting.
And in places like Mali, I mean, we have seen some human rights atrocities taking place.
Human Rights Watch accused on Monday the Malian armed forces and foreign fighters from the Wagner Group of executing dozens of civilians in central Mali since December 2022 during anti-jihadist operations.
Absolutely. The insurgency in Mali is between a number of different groups. And for a long time, the UN had a peacekeeping force that to a large extent was trying to keep the parties apart. What the Malian military has done using Wagner troops is conduct these offensive operations into villages where there was more jihadist activity and against the rebels. And their methods of operation have tracked with the kinds of anti-partisan warfare methods that the Russians employed in Chechnya and much further back. They tend to do targeted operations against jihadists or against rebels, but they also go into their villages and kidnap the children of tribal elders, village chiefs. They tend to conduct demonstrative killings of local civilians for aiding and abetting, with the explicit threat that if there are further instances of instability emerging from those villages, then there will be much wider collective punishment. And in some instances, the Russians have gone in and essentially, with the Malian military, conducted massacres.
Is that another reason why, if you're an African leader, it's actually quite appealing to have the Russians helping you rather than the West, because the West would balk at the idea of human rights atrocities like that, or ethnic cleansing, effectively.
The view of the Western approach by many of these leaders is that the West freezes the situation, uses human rights as a reason for preventing the government from doing anything, and then conducts the kinds of operations that are relevant for Western interests, like counterterrorism, but isn't really putting in the resource to fundamentally change the situation. Whereas what the Russians have done in Mali, for example, is they have allowed the Malian government to conduct a large operation and seize Kidal, which is one of the major centers the rebels were operating from. And that, to the majority of the population, particularly when it's filtered through Russian propaganda, is framed as the Malian military actually achieving something, actually changing the status quo. And so what it gives these leaders is a sense of agency, a sense that they are making decisions and controlling events, which is a hugely powerful thing. Secondly, there is a strong sense in many of these countries that the West is hypocritical, because Western interest has been absorbed by the conflict in Ukraine or even the conflict in Gaza. And so lots of them saw that they were a second-tier priority. They lost faith that there was really going to be a policy from the West that would fix the problems in their states. And Russia came along and offered them something which looked attractive. For the Russians, of course, the other aspect of this is that once you get a country to start committing egregious human rights violations, it becomes drastically harder for the West to stick around and to continue to do business, let alone provide security assistance. And so they're actually losing the choice to engage with the West, which is something that the Russians are quite comfortable with. The irony is that the Russians acknowledge internally that this is in some ways a colonial project and is at serious risk over time of being perceived as precisely that by their partners.
So whilst it's playing on the idea of historic colonialism and distancing these countries from the West, it is effectively Russia taking over. One of the reasons, as you've explained, that they want to do that is that they get rights to mining in these countries. Give us a sense of how important that is to the Russian government.
The Russian government has enough money from petrochemicals. The problem the Russian government has is that money coming directly from Russia can't get into the international market easily because of sanctions. And so they become hyper-dependent upon the UAE and a couple of other places, Turkey, where they can get some money out into the international system. What they go after in Africa is very often gold. You can transfer gold, you can exchange gold for cash in pretty much any market, and there's a pretty limited audit trail. And so if you are generating the gold outside of Russia and you are converting it to cash outside of Russia, then this can create a very large body of capital that you can then use through front companies outside of the sanctions system. And it's worth noting as well that so long as there are direct economic relationships tying these countries to Russia, then these countries are very unlikely to join the sanctions regime. And then there's a third element, which is control of critical resources. If we look at one of the things they're interested in Mali, it's lithium, absolutely critical for batteries and most electronics these days. If we look at what they're very interested in Niger, it's France's uranium concession, which, given that France is to a large extent dependent upon Russia for its nuclear fuel, and the European energy system in terms of nuclear energy is still critically dependent upon Russian fuel enriched uranium, trying to undermine alternative sources of supply is a very strategic play. So they are going after strategic resources in that way.
Is there a sense that they've managed to get a model now where they can make the best use of Wagner? They can still have funds coming in and influence extending across Africa without the fear that Wagner will turn against the Kremlin. Do you think that possibility has been completely eliminated now?
I think they have eliminated the risk of a Wagner-led mutiny. They do have a challenge, though, which is that they are taking on commitments which are now hard commitments in quite a lot of countries. And there's a reason why the West failed to improve security in these states. These are really difficult, intractable problems. And it does take quite a lot of resource to solve these kinds of problems. And so there is this interesting question, which is that now that they have lost the flexibility that the deniability of Wagner offered them in terms of being able to disengage from some territories, whether we're going to see a process of overstretch where they've taken on more commitments than they are able to sustain. But ultimately, this is a serious problem for the West because it shows that while we are becoming increasingly myopic and increasingly concerned with the security threat to us directly, which is understandable, the Russians are still trying to compete with this globally.
So whilst Wagner last summer was a huge problem for the Kremlin, it's really a problem for the West and one we shouldn't be ignoring.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Stories of Our Times, which from next week, as you may have heard, becomes The Story, with me, Manveen Rana, and my guest, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, Dr. Jack Watling. The producer today was Chris Wade. The executive producer was Kate Ford, and sound design was by Mao Lasetto. If you can, please do leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It'll help others to find us. Thanks for listening. See you again soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.